In fact, since black holes have such strong gravitational fields, your passage through time would slow way down. Your watch would tick about 10,000 times more slowly than those of your friends back on Earth. If you were to hover just above the black hole's event horizon in this manner for a year, and then climb up the cable to your waiting starship for a short yet leisurely journey home, upon arrival at Earth, you would find that more than 10,000 years had passed since your initial departure. You would have successfully used the black hole as a kind of time machine, allowing you to travel to Earth's distant future. To get a sense of the extreme scales involved, a star with the mass of the Sun would be a black hole if its radius were not its actual value, about 450,000 miles, but, instead, just under 2 miles. Imagine, the whole of the Sun squeezed to fit comfortably within Upper Manhattan. A teaspoonful of such a compressed Sun would weigh about as much as Mount Everest. To make a black hole out of the Earth, we would need to crush it into a sphere whose radius is less than half an inch. For a long time, physicists were skeptical about whether such extreme configurations of matter could ever actually occur, and many thought that black holes were merely a reflection of an overworked theoretician's imagination. Nevertheless, during the last decade, an increasingly convincing body of experimental evidence for the existence of black holes has accumulated. Of course, since they are black, they cannot be observed directly by scanning the sky with telescopes. Instead, astronomers search for black holes by seeking anomalous behavior of other more ordinary light-emitting stars that may be positioned just outside a black hole's event horizon. For instance, as dust and gas from the outer layers of nearby ordinary stars fall toward the event horizon of a black hole, they are accelerated to nearly the speed of light. At such speeds, friction within the maelstrom of downward swirling material generates an enormous amount of heat, causing the dust-gas mixture to glow, giving off both ordinary visible light and X-rays. Since this radiation is produced just outside the event horizon, it can escape the black hole and travel through space to be observed and studied directly. General relativity makes detailed predictions about properties that such X-ray emissions will have. Observation of these predicted properties gives strong, albeit indirect, evidence for the existence of black holes. For example, mounting evidence indicates that there is a very massive black hole, some 2.5 million times as massive as the Sun, sitting in the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. And even this seemingly gargantuan black hole pales in comparison to what astronomers believe to reside in the core of the astonishingly luminous quasars that are scattered throughout the cosmos, black holes whose masses may well be billions of times that of the Sun. Schwarzschild died only a few months after finding his solution, from a skin disease he contracted at the Russian front. He was 42. His tragically brief encounter with Einstein's theory of gravity uncovered one of the most striking and mysterious facets of the natural world. The second example in which general relativity flexes its muscle concerns the origin and evolution of the whole universe. As we have seen, Einstein showed that space and time respond to the presence of mass and energy. This distortion of space-time affects the motion of other cosmic bodies moving in the vicinity of the resulting warps. In turn, the precise way in which these bodies move, by virtue of their own mass and energy, has a further effect on the warping of space-time, which further affects the motion of the bodies, and on the interconnected cosmic dance goes. Through the equations of general relativity, equations rooted in geometrical insights into curved space, spearheaded by the great 19th century mathematician George Bernhard Riemann, more about Riemann later, Einstein was able to describe the mutual evolution of space, time, and matter quantitatively. To his great surprise, when the equations are applied beyond an isolated context within the universe, such as a planet or a comet orbiting a star, to the universe as a whole, a remarkable conclusion is reached. The overall size of the spatial universe must be changing in time. That is, either the fabric of the universe is stretching or it is shrinking, but it is not simply staying put. The equations of general relativity show this explicitly. This conclusion was too much even for Einstein. He had overturned the collective intuition regarding the nature of space and time built up through everyday experiences over thousands of years, but the notion of an always existing, never changing universe was too ingrained for even this radical thinker to abandon. For this reason, Einstein revisited his equations and modified them by introducing something known as a cosmological constant, an additional term that allowed him to avoid this prediction and once again bask in the comfort of a static universe. However, 12 years later, through detailed measurements of distant galaxies, the American astronomer Edwin Hubble experimentally established that the universe is expanding. In a now famous story in the annals of science, Einstein then returned to the original form of his equations, citing his temporary modification of them as the biggest blunder of his life. His initial unwillingness to accept the conclusion notwithstanding, Einstein's theory predicted the expansion of the universe. In fact, in the early 1920s, years before Hubble's measurements, the Russian meteorologist Alexander Friedman had used Einstein's original equations to show, in some detail, that all galaxies would be carried along on the substrate of stretching spatial fabric, thereby speedily moving away from all others. Hubble's observations, and numerous subsequent ones, have thoroughly verified this astonishing conclusion of general relativity. By offering the explanation for the expansion of the universe, Einstein achieved one of the greatest intellectual feats of all time. If the fabric of space is stretching, thereby increasing the distance between galaxies that are carried along on the cosmic flow, we can imagine running the evolution backward in time to learn about the origin of the universe. In reverse, the fabric of space shrinks, bringing all galaxies closer and closer to each other. Like the contents of a pressure cooker, as the shrinking universe compresses the galaxies together, the temperature dramatically increases, stars disintegrate, and a hot plasma of matter's elementary constituents is formed. As the fabric continues to shrink, the temperature rises unabated, as does the density of the primordial plasma. As we imagine running the clock backward from the age of the presently observed universe, about 15 billion years, the universe as we know it is crushed to an ever smaller size. The matter making up everything, every car, house, building, mountain on Earth, the Earth itself, the Moon, Saturn, Jupiter, and every other planet, the Sun and every other star in the Milky Way, the Andromeda Galaxy with its 100 billion stars, and each and every other of the more than 100 billion galaxies, is squeezed by a cosmic vise to astounding density. And as the clock is turned back to ever earlier times, the whole of the cosmos is compressed to the size of an orange, a lemon, a pea, a grain of sand, and to yet tinier size still. Extrapolating all the way back to the beginning, the universe would appear to have begun as a point, an image we will critically re-examine in later chapters, in which all matter and energy is squeezed together to unimaginable density and temperature. It is believed that a cosmic fireball, the Big Bang, erupted from this volatile mixture, spewing forth the seeds from which the universe, as we know it, evolved. The image of the Big Bang as a cosmic explosion ejecting the material contents of the universe like shrapnel from an exploding bomb is a useful one to bear in mind, but it is a little misleading. When a bomb explodes, it does so at a particular location in space and at a particular moment in time. Its contents are ejected into the surrounding space. In the Big Bang, there is no surrounding space. As we devolve the universe backward toward the beginning, the squeezing together of all material content occurs because all of space is shrinking. The orange size, the pea size, the grain of sand-sized devolution describes the whole of the universe, not something within the universe. Carrying on to the beginning, there is simply no space outside the primordial pinpoint grenade. Instead, the Big Bang is the eruption of compressed space whose unfurling, like a tidal wave, carries along matter and energy, even to this day. Is general relativity right? No deviations from the predictions of general relativity have been found in experiments performed with our present level of technology. Only time will tell if greater experimental precision will ultimately uncover some, thereby showing this theory, too, to be only an approximate description of how nature actually works. The systematic testing of theories to greater and greater levels of accuracy is, certainly, one of the ways science progresses, but it is not the only way. In fact, we have already seen this. The search for a new theory of gravity was initiated, not by an experimental refutation of Newton's theory, but rather by the conflict of Newtonian gravity with another theory, special relativity. It was only after the discovery of general relativity as a competing theory of gravity that experimental flaws in Newton's theory were identified by seeking out tiny but measurable ways in which the two theories differ. Thus, internal theoretical inconsistencies can play as pivotal a role in driving progress as do experimental data. For the last half century, physics has been faced with still another theoretical conflict whose severity is on par with that between special relativity and Newtonian gravity. General relativity appears to be fundamentally incompatible with another extremely well-tested theory, quantum mechanics. Regarding the material covered in this chapter, the conflict prevents physicists from understanding what really happens to space, time, and matter when crushed together fully at the moment of the Big Bang, or at the central point of a black hole. But more generally, the conflict alerts us to a fundamental deficiency in our conception of nature. The resolution of this conflict has eluded attempts by some of the greatest theoretical physicists, giving it a well-deserved reputation as the central problem of modern theoretical physics. Understanding the conflict requires familiarity with some basic features of quantum theory, to which we now turn. Chapter 4. Microscopic Weirdness. A bit worn out from their trans-solar system expedition, George and Gracie return to Earth and head over to the H-Bar for some post-space sojourning refreshments. George orders the usual, papaya juice on the rocks for himself, and a vodka tonic for Gracie, and kicks back in his chair, hands clasped behind his head, to enjoy a freshly lit cigar. Just as he prepares to inhale, though, he is stunned to find that the cigar has vanished from between his teeth. Thinking that the cigar must somehow have slipped from his mouth, George sits forward expecting to find it burning a hole in his shirt or trousers. But it is not there. The cigar is not to be found. Gracie, roused by George's frantic movement, glances over and spots the cigar lying on the counter directly behind George's chair. "Strange," George says. "How in the heck could it have fallen over there? It's as if it went right through my head, but my tongue isn't burned and I don't seem to have any new holes." Gracie examines George and reluctantly confirms that his tongue and head appear to be perfectly normal. As the drinks have just arrived, George and Gracie shrug their shoulders and chalk up the fallen cigar to one of life's little mysteries. But the weirdness at the H-Bar continues. George looks into his papaya juice and notices that the ice cubes are incessantly rattling around, bouncing off each other and the sides of the glass like overcharged automobiles in a bumper car arena. And this time he is not alone. Gracie holds up her glass, which is about half the size of George's, and both of them see that her ice cubes are bouncing around even more frantically. They can hardly make out the individual cubes as they all blur together into an icy mass. But none of this compares to what happens next. As George and Gracie stare at her rattling drink with wide-eyed wonderment, They see a single ice cube pass through the side of her glass and drop down to the bar. They grab the glass and see that it is fully intact. Somehow the ice cube went right through the solid glass without causing any damage.
"Must be post-spacewalk hallucinations," says George.
They each fight off the frenzy of careening ice cubes to down their drinks in one go and head home to recover. Little do George and Gracie realize that in their haste to leave, they mistook a decorative door painted on a wall of the bar for the real thing. The patrons of the H-Bar, though, are well accustomed to people passing through walls and hardly take note of George and Gracie's abrupt departure. A century ago, while Conrad and Freud were illuminating the heart and soul of darkness, the German physicist Max Planck shed the first ray of light on quantum mechanics, a conceptual framework that proclaims, among other things, that the H-Bar experiences of George and Gracie, when scaled down to the microscopic realm, need not be attributed to clouded faculties. Such unfamiliar and bizarre happenings are typical of how our universe, on extremely small scales, actually behaves. The Quantum Framework. Quantum mechanics is a conceptual framework for understanding the microscopic properties of the universe. And just as special relativity and general relativity require dramatic changes in our worldview when things are moving very quickly or when they are very massive, quantum mechanics reveals that the universe has equally, if not more, startling properties when examined on atomic and subatomic distance scales. In 1965, Richard Feynman, one of the greatest practitioners of quantum mechanics, wrote, "There was a time when the newspapers said that only 12 men understood the theory of relativity. I do not believe there ever was such a time. There might have been a time when only one man did because he was the only guy who caught on before he wrote his paper. But after people read the paper, a lot of people understood the theory of relativity in one way or other, certainly more than 12. On the other hand, I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." Although Feynman expressed this view more than four decades ago, it applies equally well today. What he meant is that although the special and general theories of relativity require a drastic revision of previous ways of seeing the world, when one fully accepts the basic principles underlying them, the new and unfamiliar implications for space and time follow directly from careful, logical reasoning. If you ponder the descriptions of Einstein's work in the preceding two chapters with adequate intensity, you will, if even for just a moment, recognize the inevitability of the conclusions we have drawn. Quantum mechanics is different. By 1928 or so, many of the mathematical formulas and rules of quantum mechanics had been put in place, and, ever since, it has been used to make the most precise and successful numerical predictions in the history of science. But in a real sense, those who use quantum mechanics find themselves following rules and formulas laid down by the founding fathers of the theory, calculational procedures that are straightforward to carry out, without really understanding why the procedures work or what they really mean. Unlike relativity, few, if any, people ever grasp quantum mechanics at a soulful level. What are we to make of this? Does it mean that on a microscopic level the universe operates in ways so obscure and unfamiliar that the human mind, evolved over eons to cope with phenomena on familiar everyday scales, is unable to fully grasp what really goes on? Or might it be that through historical accident, physicists have constructed an extremely awkward formulation of quantum mechanics that, although quantitatively successful, obfuscates the true nature of reality? No one knows. Maybe sometime in the future, some clever person will see clearer to a new formulation that will fully reveal the whys and the whats of quantum mechanics. And then again, maybe not. The only thing we know with certainty is that quantum mechanics absolutely and unequivocally shows us that a number of basic concepts essential to our understanding of the familiar everyday world fail to have any meaning
when our focus narrows to the microscopic realm. As a result, we must significantly modify both our language and our reasoning when attempting to understand and explain the universe on atomic and subatomic scales. In the following sections, we will develop the basics of this language and describe a number of the remarkable surprises it entails. If along the way quantum mechanics seems to you to be altogether bizarre or even ludicrous, you should bear in mind two things. First, beyond the fact that it is a mathematically coherent theory, the only reason we believe in quantum mechanics is because it yields predictions that have been verified to astounding accuracy. If someone can tell you volumes of intimate details of your childhood in excruciating detail, it's not hard to believe their claim of being your long-lost sibling. Second, you are not alone in having this reaction to quantum mechanics. It is a view held to a greater or lesser extent by some of the most revered physicists of all time. Einstein refused to accept quantum mechanics fully, and even Niels Bohr, one of the central pioneers of quantum theory and one of its strongest proponents, once remarked that if you do not get dizzy sometimes when you think about quantum mechanics, then you have not really understood it. It's too hot in the kitchen. The road to quantum mechanics began with a puzzling problem. Imagine that your oven at home is perfectly insulated, that you set it to some temperature, say 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and you give it enough time to heat up. Even if you had sucked all the air from the oven before turning it on, by heating its walls you generate waves of radiation in its interior. This is the same kind of radiation, heat and light in the form of electromagnetic waves, that is emitted by the surface of the sun, or a glowing hot iron poker. Here's the problem. Electromagnetic waves carry energy. Life on Earth, for example, relies crucially on solar energy transmitted from the sun to the Earth by electromagnetic waves. At the beginning of the 20th century, physicists calculated the total energy carried by all of the electromagnetic radiation inside an oven at a chosen temperature. Using well-established calculational procedures, they came up with a ridiculous answer. For any chosen temperature, the total energy in the oven is infinite. It was clear to everyone that this was nonsense. A hot oven can embody significant energy, but surely not an infinite amount. To understand the resolution proposed by Planck, it is worth understanding the problem in a bit more detail. It turns out that when Maxwell's electromagnetic theory is applied to the radiation in an oven, it shows that the waves generated by the hot walls must have a whole number of peaks and troughs that fit perfectly between opposite surfaces. Physicists use three terms to describe these waves: wavelength, frequency, and amplitude. The wavelength is the distance between successive peaks or successive troughs of the waves. More peaks and troughs mean a shorter wavelength, as they must all be crammed in between the fixed walls of the oven. The frequency refers to the number of up and down cycles of oscillation that a wave completes every second. It turns out that the frequency is determined by the wavelength and vice versa. Longer wavelengths imply lower frequency. Shorter wavelengths imply higher frequency. To see why, think of what happens when you produce waves by shaking a long rope that is tied down at one end. To generate a long wavelength, you leisurely shake your end up and down. The frequency of the waves matches the number of cycles per second your arm goes through and is consequently fairly low. But to generate short wavelengths, you shake your end more frantically, more frequently, so to speak, and this yields a higher frequency wave. Finally, physicists use the term amplitude to describe the maximum height or depth of a wave. In case you find electromagnetic waves a bit abstract, another good analogy to keep in mind are the waves that are produced by plucking a violin string. Different wave frequencies correspond to different musical notes. The higher the frequency, the higher the note. The amplitude of a wave on a violin string is determined by how hard you pluck it. A harder pluck means that you put more energy into the wave disturbance, More energy, therefore, corresponds to a larger amplitude. You can hear this as the resulting tone is louder. Similarly, less energy corresponds to a smaller amplitude and a lower volume of sound. By making use of 19th century thermodynamics, physicists were able to determine how much energy the hot walls of the oven would pump into electromagnetic waves of each allowed wavelength, how hard the walls would, in effect, pluck each wave. The result they found is simple to state. Each of the allowed waves, regardless of its wavelength, carries the same amount of energy, with the precise amount determined by the temperature of the oven. In other words, all of the possible wave patterns within the oven are on completely equal footing when it comes to the amount of energy they embody. At first, this seems like an interesting, albeit innocuous, result. It isn't. It spells the downfall of what has come to be known as classical physics. The reason is this. Even though requiring that all waves have a whole number of peaks and troughs rules out an enormous variety of conceivable wave patterns in the oven, there are still an infinite number that are possible, those with ever more peaks and troughs. Since each wave pattern carries the same amount of energy, an infinite number of them translates into an infinite amount of energy. At the turn of the 20th century, there was a gargantuan fly in the theoretical ointment. Making lumps at the turn of the 20th century. In 1900, Planck made an inspired guess that allowed a way out of this puzzle and would earn him the 1918 Nobel Prize in Physics. To get a feel for his resolution, imagine that you and a huge crowd of people, infinite in number, are crammed into a large, cold warehouse run by a miserly landlord. There is a fancy digital thermostat on the wall that controls the temperature, but you are shocked when you discover the charges that the landlord levies for heat. If the thermostat is set to 50 degrees Fahrenheit, everyone must give the landlord $50. If it is set to 55 degrees, everyone must pay $55, and so on. You realize that since you are sharing the warehouse with an infinite number of companions, the landlord will earn an infinite amount of money if you turn on the heat at all. But on closer reading of the landlord's rules of payment, you see a loophole. Because the landlord is a very busy man, he does not want to give change, especially not to an infinite number of individual tenants. So he works on an honor system. Those who can pay exactly what they owe do so. Otherwise, they pay only as much as they can without requiring change. And so, wanting to involve everyone but wanting to avoid the exorbitant charges for heat, you compel your comrades to organize the wealth of the group in the following manner. One person carries all of the pennies, one person carries all of the nickels, one carries all of the dimes, one carries all of the quarters, and so on through dollar bills, $5 bills, $10 bills, 20s, 50s, hundreds, thousands, and ever larger and unfamiliar denominations. You brazenly set the thermostat to 80 degrees and await the landlord's arrival. When he does come, the person carrying pennies goes to pay first and turns over 8,000. The person carrying nickels then turns over 1,600 of them. The person carrying dimes turns over 800. The person with quarters turns over 320. The person with dollars gives the landlord 80. The person with $5 bills turns over 16. The person with $10 bills gives him 8, the person with 20s gives him 4, and the person with 50s hands over 1, since two $50 bills would exceed the necessary payment, thereby requiring change. But everyone else carries only a denomination, a minimal lump of money, that exceeds the required payment. Therefore, they cannot pay the landlord, and hence, rather than getting the infinite amount of money he expected, the landlord leaves with the paltry sum of $690. Planck made use of a very similar strategy to reduce the ridiculous result of infinite energy in an oven to one that is finite. Here's how. Planck boldly guessed that the energy carried by an electromagnetic wave in the oven, like money, comes in lumps. The energy can be one times some fundamental energy denomination, or two times it, or three times it, and so forth. But that's it. just as you can't have one-third of a penny or 2.5 quarters, Planck declared that when it comes to energy, no fractions are allowed. Now, our monetary denominations are determined by the United States Treasury. Seeking a more fundamental explanation, Planck suggested that the energy denomination of a wave, the minimal lump of energy that it can have, is determined by its frequency. Specifically, he posited that the minimum energy a wave can have is proportional to its frequency. Larger frequency, shorter wavelength, implies larger minimum energy. Smaller frequency, longer wavelength, implies smaller minimum energy. Roughly speaking, just as gentle ocean waves are long and luxurious, while harsh ones are short and choppy, long wavelength radiation is intrinsically less energetic than short wavelength radiation. Here's the punchline. Planck's calculations showed that this lumpiness of the allowed energy in each wave cured the previous ridiculous result of infinite total energy. It's not hard to see why. When an oven is heated to some chosen temperature, the calculations based on 19th century thermodynamics predicted the common energy that each and every wave would supposedly contribute to the total. But like those comrades who cannot contribute the common amount of money they each owe to the landlord because the monetary denomination they carry is too large, if the minimum energy a particular wave can carry exceeds the energy it is supposed to contribute, it can't contribute and instead lies dormant. Since, according to Planck, the minimum energy a wave can carry is proportional to its frequency, as we examine waves in the oven of ever larger frequency, shorter wavelength, sooner or later the minimum energy they can carry is bigger than the expected energy contribution. Like the comrades in the warehouse entrusted with denominations larger than $50 bills, these waves with ever larger frequencies cannot contribute the amount of energy demanded by 19th century physics. And so, just as only a finite number of comrades are able to contribute to the total heat payment, leading to a finite amount of total money, only a finite number of waves are able to contribute to the oven's total energy, again leading to a finite amount of total energy. Be it energy or money, the lumpiness of the fundamental units and the ever-increasing size of these lumps as we go to higher frequencies or to larger monetary denominations changes an infinite answer to one that is finite. By eliminating the manifest nonsense of an infinite result, Planck had taken an important step. But what really made people believe that his guess had validity is that the finite answer that his new approach gave for the energy in an oven agreed spectacularly with experimental measurements. Specifically, Planck found that by adjusting one parameter that entered into his new calculations, he could predict accurately the measured energy of an oven for any selected temperature. This one parameter is the proportionality factor between the frequency of a wave and the minimal lump of energy it can have. Planck found that this proportionality factor, now known as Planck's constant, and denoted as a lowercase h with a horizontal line through it, is about a billionth of a billionth of a billionth in everyday units. The tiny value of Planck's constant means that the size of the energy lumps are typically very small. This is why, for example, it seems to us that we can cause the energy of a wave on a violin string, and hence the volume of sound it produces, to change continuously. In reality, though, the energy of the wave passes through discrete steps, a la Planck, but the size of the steps is so small that the discrete jumps from one volume to another appear to be smooth. According to Planck's assertion, the size of these jumps in energy grows as the frequency of the waves gets higher and higher, while wavelengths get shorter and shorter. This is the crucial ingredient that resolves the infinite energy paradox. As we shall see, Planck's quantum hypothesis does far more than allow us to understand the energy content of an oven. It overturns much about the world that we hold to be self-evident. The smallness of h-bar confines most of these radical departures from life as usual to the microscopic realm. But if h-bar happened to be much larger than it is, the strange happenings at the h-bar would actually be commonplace. As we shall see, their microscopic counterparts certainly are. What are the lumps?